Welcome to RPG Ramblings with Jeff Jones. This is a weekly show exploring the various details of the tabletop RPG hobby through discussions with interesting people. Today, Michael Scott joins me to talk about his upcoming cyberpunk Kickstarter, Cyberblood. If you're itching for some fast-paced action, look no further. I have a Patreon that can always use some backers. The current cadre covers most of my Zoom costs, and to them, I am most thankful. Our inside man has just cut the power to the warehouse, and it's time to breach. Sisters and brothers, it is time to ramble. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
Well, thanks for joining me tonight.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And thanks for letting me on after I left you on read for a week or whatever. Yeah. That was super embarrassing. I apologize.
Well, that's okay, because I really wasn't feeling great that night. I was tired. I really didn't feel great. I think it might have been... We might have been having the fires going on in the bad air.
Mm.
So you didn't get the bad air. So because of Canada,
right?
Yeah. So it worked out. It worked out. Yeah,
that's so good. So it was like when you don't want to go to a party and then someone cancels the plan and you're like, oh, thank goodness.
Well, no, it wasn't quite that bad, but yeah, it was fine. It was fine. So I'm a much better, I'm more on my A. I mean, A game tonight, but at least closer to A rather than being closer to D.
Yeah. Well, that's good. That's good to hear. Yeah. I was in Michigan when those fires kind of kicked off and I was like, you know, it wasn't quite as bad as it was in like the East Coast, where I think New York got really, really bad. But yeah, it was pretty gnarly, even in Michigan.
Well, when it happened before, when the California fires were burning.
Yeah.
And it never actually hit like the lower, like it never became breathable. It just started making the sunsets and the sky just seemed weird.
Yeah.
Here we had the sky being weird. Then all of a sudden we just had like smog, which was, we're not used to, nobody knows what smog is around here. It's confusing.
Mm. But yeah.
Anyway, that's the only, probably one of the few benefits of living in the middle of nowhere. So is lack of smog.
Oh, I can imagine that being a big benefit.
Yeah. Just everything else is a downer, but that's okay. So you've got a Kickstarter. That's what I've heard. Zach told me you had a Kickstarter.
Yeah, I certainly do. It's for my cyberpunk role-playing game, Cyberblood. And it's probably happening next week.
Well, that's exciting. So is your first Kickstarter?
Oh, yeah. It is. I'm very much new to the whole crowdfunding scene, both as a kind of creator and as a contributor, right? I kind of missed the bus on a lot of that stuff when it was kind of brand new. So learning a lot.
Yeah. It's going to be quite a ride. It's hard to prepare people for it. Last Kickstarter I did, this fellow that was joined me in this whole adventure with the sci-fi, zine that I put on, and I couldn't quite prepare them for what it's going to be because it's hard to describe. You can't really tell people they're in it. Once you've been through it, you join the brotherhood and the sisterhood. Right. So you are now part of, you will have been baptized in the fire and you will have come out both a better person and a worse person at the same time. So that's okay.
Yeah, it definitely does feel very, very intense in a way that I was not expecting, but it's a lot of pressure, you know. That's what it kind of feels like, you know.
Yeah, because all of a sudden you look at projections, you're looking at day to day, trying to figure out what you're going to make, you know, what you want, you know. It's like Cameron, who's maybe it was Zach, it stayed like there's a number that you state, you know, that you want to fund at, you know, that's the minimum, but there really is a number everybody's looking at getting,
right?
You know, and and sometimes you know, some people get lucky, or I say lucky, that's not a good word. Sometimes people's Kickstarters do really well and it performs much better and faster than they do. I've had people who had Kickstarter at amounts I thought were high, and almost through the whole campaign, I didn't think they were going to make it. I really, for me, I would have killed it. But at the end, they pulled it off somehow. Mm-hmm. So it's like, you just don't know. You don't know. So, but you got Cyberblood. So Cyberblood is, what is Cyberblood?
Cyberblood is a brutal kind of 90s and 80s inspired cyberpunk game. And I think it kind of draws more from kind of anime and action movies specifically, more so than some of the stock that I think the other maybe cyberpunk systems you may have heard of kind of base their material on. So think Ghost in the Shell and like RoboCop, big touchstones for us in terms of kind of the feel of the world and the kind of setting.
So what kind of system? You have a very nice looking website to support this. I mean, as far as the work front end, yeah. Even though I did state, I usually do very little research. I did a little more research for years than I normally do. I perused through the website and saw it was very good. I couldn't quite understand what system or the mechanics were for the system. But you did mention it's very brutal. And it was, if I recall correctly, that it was not a, it's going to be very dark and very brutal mechanics as far as like survivability for characters and that sort of thing.
Yeah, it is, you know, I don't want to like, you know, scare people away, because it is not the kind of game where you need kind of past experience. You don't need to be a hardened role play veteran in order to enjoy Cyberblood. You just need to have an interest in the system and an interest in the setting, and you're going to have a good time. But I say brutal because it does expect you to kind of play with your smarts. You know, it does expect you to kind of treat the world, you know, as if it was the real world, treat it realistically, you know. There's multiple reasons for that. The largest is that the system, you know, characters are pretty squishy, you know, they don't have a lot of health, and it is a science fiction world, but it is kind of more like, it is like near future science. So there's not like magic healing spells or you can't revive people from the dead. If somebody, you know, gets, you know, absolutely destroyed by something, they're not coming back, you know, they're gone. And mechanically that's supported by the fact that, you know, characters, you know, you might roll a really strong character, you might roll a really weak character, but on average characters, you're looking at like 30, 35 health, you know, when you start off, and your kind of base level weaponry is going to do between 10 and 15 damage per hit. So you take two shots from like a high damage weapon, you know, you might be unconscious. You take a third shot, you're probably gone, you know? So, and obviously there's variations. There's small, there's weaker weapons, and there's really powerful devastating weapons. And of course there's body armor and all sorts of mitigating factors, but the system is designed to make combat sort of like a punctuation point in the story, and not just something you do willy-nilly and kind of, you know, get into a fight for no reason, you know.
That makes sense. And I think the thing is it sounds like with what you're describing, you also, it's not like people are super squishy, kind of like with, say, like with Ninja Crawl Classics or even Old School Essentials, where, you know, characters running around 4 hit points and a sword does 1d8, but it's still, you have to think a little bit before you start engaging in something.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, this is something we can get in more depth later, but one of the other mechanics, or I should say lack thereof, is that Cyberblood does not have an experience point system. There's multiple reasons for that. But one of the side effects of having no like leveling up and experience points in the traditional sense is that you take away that incentive for players to treat the world like a video game and just go, oh, I just want to go smash the nearest monster. I just want to go kill the nearest goblin or whatever. You know, there, that incentive is gone. So, you know, it kind of, without explicitly telling the players to behave this way, there's nothing really in it for players to be murder hobos, you know, in that, you know, I don't like to use the term murder hobos because I think it's like pejorative for a certain style of play. Yeah. But I think that it takes away that incentive to be like, in D&D, you go beat up a monster or someone that maybe doesn't deserve it. You know, you're going to get experience points from it if your dungeon master is following rules as written. Cyberblood, that doesn't exist. So unless you're planning on, you know, stealing everything from this guy's pockets, you know, you're probably not going to get very much for killing a random person or, you know, picking a fight with somebody who doesn't deserve it.
Yeah. And that's good when you start having mechanics that kind of, really mechanics should support the style of play that you're wanting. So you're rewarding people for engaging in, not say rewarding people to engage in combat, but just not excessively. So there's that kind of balance. It's like, you don't want people to run away like at all opportunities. It's like, it's kind of interesting. Someone was talking, I think it was about Sword and Sorcery, and I don't know how there's a way of mechanically doing this, but a lot of times there'll be like a, you know, like a fight with a creature and maybe somebody withdraws and then maybe later on they'll come back again, but they'll be better. But, you know, it'd be kind of interesting when you deal with genres, like what sort of mechanics can you do where, you know, where you can support that kind of play to get that kind of feel. But it sounds like, so what kind of mechanics are you using for this resolution? Are you using D6s, D20s? Is it a pool system?
It's largely a D20 system. You know, if you want to be like, you know, in its purest, most kind of reductive form, you know, if you are coming to Cyberblood from other, you know, popular D20 systems, like, you know, D&D is the big one. It's going to feel, you're going to feel at home. You know, you're going to be like, well, I roll the D20 and then I add whatever my skill modifier is.
Okay.
So it's going to feel comfortable if that's the style of play you are familiar with. But it cuts out a lot of the fat. A huge priority for me in designing Cyberblood was making combat fun and making it quick. And you can have that in other D20 systems, you know, D&D especially. But because that was the kind of point of comparison, because it's the elephant in the room, I wanted to do away with the sluggish nature of D&D's combat. Sometimes it can get very slow. And for me, the thing I identified in that respect was the fact that there was like an excessive amount of dice rolling, because generally speaking, you know, at low levels, you're rolling maybe 2 to 3 dice per player per turn. When you get higher levels, you might be rolling way more than that. But at the base level, that's kind of what you're looking at. So the way I fixed that was that Cyberblood's damage for most weapons is fixed. You don't roll for damage.
Okay.
You roll to succeed in your attack, and then you have static damage, which makes more sense, you know, anyway, because if you're shooting a bullet out of a gun, you know, that bullet's not going to come out of the gun faster one time when you shoot it and slower another time. It's the same bullet, it's the same gun. So having static damage also made like sense in the setting.
Yeah, because you know, you're stating that, and I was kind of thinking, it's like, it seems like either weapons do, and it does make sense. And I think the other thing too, I was thinking about is like conditions might be the other thing where something, you know, could do. How would you handle that? But I think having standard weapon damage definitely speeds things up in a way.
Yeah.
The downside is people can also do the math in their head, which may or may not be a good thing. As far as like, well, I know I can take one more hit, or I can only take 2 more hits, or things like that. But still, I think as far as what you're doing is quick resolution.
Yeah, yeah. I think, you know, and that's not to say that Cyberblood's combat is like super ultra simplistic. Like, you can have a lot of fun with it. There's cool abilities. There's lots of different gadgets. That's a huge draw of the game. And, you know, so there is a lot of like tactical and strategic balancing in the game. But on average, you're going to be rolling half the number of dice in a Cyberblood combat that you would be rolling in an equivalent Dungeons and Dragons combat. And you're going to see, you know, just as much action, if not more so, but it is going to move faster. You know, you're not going to have tons of turns of people healing. You're not going to have people rolling death saving throws and dragging things out. You know, I'm really proud of the combat system, because it is simple enough to be approachable and to kind of not get gummed up with, you know, excessive kind of, you know, math, but it is also really flexible and has all these kind of cool strategic options that you can throw in there. So it moves quickly, but it doesn't move quickly because it's, you know, super simple. It moves quickly because it's just a very fluid kind of live system. So if I do say so myself,
what sort of things do you, that adds a strategic element to this? What about the mechanics allows for having more strategic options?
So a big part of that is the character classes themselves. All the character classes have two active kind of abilities that you use whenever you desire to use them. And then they have a passive ability that is just constantly giving them a buff of some kind or some kind of advantage that the other classes don't have. So a big part of the strategy comes from whatever class you chose and how you're interfacing that class with the world around you and with the team that you're working with, the other players and the classes they chose. So for example, one of the abilities of the agent class, which is your sort of rogue kind of sneaky ninja-esque kind of stereotype character, is an ability that allows them to, if they are using a particular kind of weapon, like a pistol, like something kind of light and easy to use, after they attack, they can make a melee attack right after they attack with that weapon. And additional attacks on your turn, like having more than one kind of attack action, is pretty uncommon in Cyberblood. So being able to attack and then basically double down on that attack is something pretty unique to the agent class. It's not limited to doing melee attacks. You can also kind of grapple. You can use another pistol attack. And that's just one example of the kind of flexibility with the combat. The abilities really do kind of shape the combat quite a bit.
Yeah, and in fact, you mentioned that made me think of, have you seen the movie Extraction or Extraction 2?
I've seen the first one with Chris Hemsworth, is that right?
Yeah, so he would get into melee with a pistol. And it was kind of interesting where, in some ways, it kind of made me think of that, where you have multiple actions where it's not just one thing, people shooting or people punching, but, you know, having a dynamic in combat, it does kind of play into, I guess, a genre, and also does make it very cinematic.
Yeah. And you know, every character has, you know, what sets the characters apart other than the kind of static, like stat bonuses. Like every character has different kind of skills that they're better at and different kind of buffs to their health and how high their evasion rating is, which is the Cyberblood kind of equivalent to something like armor class. It's a little different, but similar enough. The abilities are hugely influential in how people are playing the game. You know, and it's not like a standard thing where, like, oh, every class has a healing option and an attack option, or every class has a movement. It's not like that. Every class kind of just whatever fits with that class is what they got. So there are some classes that are a little more role play heavy. Their advantages are not so much combat focused, but they are exploratory and role play focused, and they benefit you in those fields. And then you have characters that are the complete opposite, that are kind of combat heavy classes. The Vigilante is one of the cool later kind of additions to the game. And this is a character class that is inspired by characters like, you know, like superheroes who don't have superpowers, that kind of character. So you're Kick-Ass, you're Batman, you know, you're kind of like V for Vendetta kind of characters, yeah. Who are just these, you know, hardened badasses but are, you know, they are human, you know? And so for this class, they have, one of their active abilities is called signature move, and signature move lets you pick from six different, attacks. You get to choose one of these six different special attacks, that is the signature move for your vigilante, and you only get one of them at the beginning of the game. And, whichever one you choose drastically is going to flavor and impact how you play your character tactically and in roleplay terms. You know, if you pick the kind of, you know, monk inspired kind of blizzard punch attack, that's a lot different than if you pick the like submission hold, which is more of like a wrestling kind of Batman-esque, you know, special ability. So it, you know, there's variety on variety, and it's something, you know, that was both really fun to do as a designer, but also, you know, the players I've play tested with and things I've kind of heard through the grapevine through groups that have been running the free version, you know, big fans of it.
So how do you handle the opponents? Do they have like class, do they utilize the same classes? Do you just handle them completely different?
Yeah, it's the enemies that you're fighting are generally, there are kind of archetypes, but generally speaking, they don't share character classes with the players. Although, you know, with some of the classes, there are going to be similarities. But a lot of it is like, if a GM, a game master understands how combat works, they're going to be easily able to put together an encounter with any kind of character or any kind of, you know, security drone or, you know, mechanized vehicle or cyborg or anything. It's going to come together relatively easily. But there are characters that are a little more specific, like inspired by stuff like Akira, which famously deals with the kind of psychic kind of mutant characters. There isn't magic in Cyberblood, but there are these kind of rare psychics. And the Esper class kind of covers that. And if you're fighting against an Esper, you can expect them to have probably pretty similar abilities to the character class version. But again, you know, it's game master's choice. If they want to, you know, create their own style of Esper, there's an entire appendix in the back of the book that has like a dozen different variations that aren't officially character classes, that are just suggestions.
So you don't do like Mook and Mook rules, or do you, how do you handle, like, do you have a differentiation like between Mooks and non-Mooks?
Not particularly. You know, I leave the kind of that kind of planning for the game master. In our on the website, you can download a free version of the rules and also a free mission module that kind of is a written kind of like a one shot, although it might take one or two sessions depending on how quickly the group moves through it. But the encounters in that are written, so it treats all NPCs that you would logically get into a confrontation with, basically with the same rules, as each other. So, if by Mook you mean like characters that have like, are you talking to like one kind of hit point kind of characters?
Yeah. Or? So like some, there's they differentiate, but sometimes they tend to have, some games will have usually like a Mook level, which are really easy to take out. And like, maybe sometimes like damage just carries over from one to the other. I mean, those types of things, smaller hit points. And sometimes there's like a mid tier, and then there's like usually a higher level. And then usually the Mooks are just easier to take out. They're kind of like the ninjas with Daredevil, at least in the comics, where it's, you know, it's not how he gets the big bad. They kind of wear him down, but it's the big bad guy he worries about. But it sounds like most of everybody they're dealing with is at a level that's maybe not up to their level, but still approximate. Not that there's any group that's, I guess, much easier to deal with.
No, like, I mean, the categories of the enemies are, there's not really a category in that sense. You know, there are definitely like variations in how the enemies behave and whatnot, but no, there's no like technical difference between like a low level, like a police patrolman or security guard versus like some really powerful psychic or something. They play by the same rules. They're going to have different abilities, different stats and whatnot, but no, there's not. I've kind of dabbled in playtesting with like kind of like swarm kind of enemies, which kind of work as how you're describing, where there's like a number of enemies that kind of act as a unit. So there's nothing like that in the core rules, but that would be something that would be spelled out if like we released an expansion that specifically dealt with a kind of enemy that was like that. We would definitely like, you know, go out of our way to spell that out, but you know, not currently a focus of Cyberblood.
Well, that makes, I mean, it's really coming down to the type of games you're wanting. And if you're trying to, again, make the combat more deadly and less John Wick, then it makes more sense too.
Right. But I mean, if you think about it, like, you know, if your enemies are, they've all got generally like, you know, 10 to 35 hit points anyway, you know, these are the lower level ones anyway, they may not have one health, but you are putting them down, you know, like incapacitating them with a single attack sometimes. So the effect is the same if your game master is, you know, kind of, you know, following the rules and kind of, you know, thinking about the encounters before they throw their players into them. So there is an expectation that the game master does like, you know, kind of like do a little bit of thinking about the strategy. It is like any RPG. It's not foolproof. You can definitely like goof it up if you're not paying attention, but you know, if done right, it can move really smoothly.
And that makes sense. And also, I mean, anytime you start adding additional rules for something else, even if it's minor, you are adding another layer of complexity that may not be what you want for the experience of the game.
Yeah. And I don't think that's, like I said, I don't think that kind of rule set is necessarily like a bad thing or anything. I've kind of like experimented with it myself, but it's, you know, I think that, you look at, you go through the books and you'll see the average level of how things are kind of balanced. You know, if you look at the free, mission module, you'll see some like, you know, good examples of like kind of early level threats.
Okay. And that'd be good for all the listeners out there, because you can't beat free.
No. Yeah. If you want a taste of Cyberblood, you can definitely go like, you know, sample it and check it out. It is on cyberblood.net. And there's, you can see all of the stuff on the site, but if you go to the download section, there is a free version of the core rules. There's a free version of the kind of gear guide. And then there is a free mission module called Raider, which is about a being hired to steal an artifact from a museum. So kind of fun, a heist.
So I guess what's the general conceit for characters and core activities that characters would be doing for this game?
So, because the system, and I did mention this a little bit earlier, but because the system doesn't have experience points, the way that your character progresses, the way it's a role-playing game by technical definition, is with money, with credits. And those credits are how you buy new equipment, buy better weapons, buy body armor, buy vehicles. You can use money to kind of bribe people, influence people. So generally speaking, and again, if a GM wants to kind of flip the script on this, you know, there's plenty of different options. But generally, how I've run games and how I ran playtesting was the adventure starts off usually with some kind of a job opportunity, some kind of an instruction, with the payment being however much the kind of danger level is, or potentially they're paid partially upfront and able to kind of outfit themselves for whatever the mission is. And it can be, you know, pretty much anything. In cyberpunk, there's a lot of like sleazy kind of business going on in the corporate world. And there's a lot of kind of underground, underworld kind of dark forces as well. So maybe you're being paid to steal something from a laboratory. Maybe you're being paid to kidnap somebody. Maybe you're being paid to rescue someone who has been kidnapped. You know, the playing as kind of mercenaries or cyberpunks literally is kind of the name of the game. And the world, you know, the specific flavor of the world is always going to be influenced by the group and by the game master. But the lore in Cyberblood makes it pretty clear that you're playing in a world that cares about money first and pretty much everything else second. So, you know, if you're the kind of person who does dirty jobs and does them well, you can expect to probably make a lot of enemies, but make a lot of money and make a lot of friends as well.
Yeah. So in some ways, kind of like, not to do too deep a comparison, kind of like Shadowrun, where it's Mr. Johnson arrives and offers you a job. So it's really mission-based crime without really, but it's up to the GM if they want to flavor it a certain way, but it's not, you know, it's kind of interesting how different, like some have tried, I think some more modern ones have, you know, structured a game strictly to be, you know, going against the man or, you know, things like that. I think there's a new one called Echo something. And I don't know if they're trying to do some sort of environmental cyberpunk. I forget the name of it.
Oh, I think I know the one you're talking about. I think I've actually seen it. Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't read anything just based on pictures, and that's a good way to draw good solid conclusions is by looking at pictures and
right.
Trying to discern. So it's kind of interesting to know what, you know, what the level is. So it really, it is a very, I don't want to say traditional, but it's very much a traditional with the trappings of certain types of media to give a certain feel using a D20 system that people find very familiar.
Yeah. I mean, if you are, of course, if you've played RPGs before, playing a new RPG is going to come easier to you than if this is your first. But I will say that I play tested this game both with people who were experienced role play gamers, you know, people who had come from big systems before. And I also play tested this with people who were kind of virgins. You know, they had never touched D&D. They had never touched role play systems at all. And this was their first game and didn't have really much of a difference between the two. You know, if your players and your game master are engaged, you're going to have a good time. It is not a like hard to learn system. It is definitely like an easy to learn system that's approachable and it has enough crunch in it to allow for kind of messing around with the loadouts and with the you know, the rule sets and the different kind of customization options that there are. So it is, you know, sometimes when you describe something as being hardcore or brutal, I try to avoid the term hardcore because I think that can, in some people's minds, that seems unapproachable. If you say something is hardcore, what they think of is, oh, this is a game that is too serious. It's not going to be fun. It's going to be, I'm going to have to do a bunch of research before I play it. That's not the case. You know,
right.
When I say it's brutal, I mean that the kind of lack of second chances and stuff is brutal. The combat can be brutal, but the system itself, you know, you can roll a character like realistically in 5 minutes, you know, and that's not an exaggeration. You know, there is a quick start character creation guide in the book and it's got lots of nice tables and descriptions and it's very beginner friendly.
I think what's kind of hard is, you know, we really don't have a good language to describe. And I think it's probably true with a lot of media, like, you know, what you're saying, because, you know, you can talk about things being crunchy and things being not crunchy, mm-hmm. like fate core. But I find that the ones that are portrayed as being much less crunchy, like fate core, can be also harder to deal with than stuff that has more rules. So, but there's also an extreme where there's so many rules, there's a rule for everything. So there's this kind of continuum, but just because something's one way still doesn't mean it's easier or harder. It's just, we don't really, I don't really have the language to properly describe, you know. And I think for you, it's like, it's easy to say, well, it's, you know, it's definitely crunchier, or it's deadlier than 5e, but it's, you know, less than OSE, but it's somewhere, you know, we really don't have that language.
Right. I totally know what you're talking about though. And I want to be careful when I say this, because I don't want to give the impression that I'm like ripping on a particular system or anything. But getting into this and going from making Cyberblood a hobby to realizing that this could be a product that people besides me could enjoy, meant doing a lot of research on other systems and looking at not only how they're like marketed and sold and designed, but also like mechanically how they function. And something that I noticed with a lot of indie RPGs is the emphasis on promoting this kind of rules light, kind of fluffy fluff over crunch kind of thing. And it's exactly what you're talking about, where you can design a bad system with 1,000 rules or a bad system with 1 rule. But you know, that it, the number of rules does not make a system more approachable, because sometimes those rules light systems, which, like I said, I did notice had become quite popular. The problem that I noticed with many of them is that they're very nebulous. You know, they don't have a lot of contingencies for edge cases. They don't have a lot of explanations about very specific things, and they don't have like a lot of examples in their rule books. Like when you were like, I want to know how to cast a certain spell in this one system, and you know, it tells you to like, you know, it tells you to perform some seemingly simple thing, like, oh, you only have to roll 1 die, but it ends up being like actually more confusing than having more rules, precisely because of how simple it is. You know, it doesn't have enough to kind of support its own claim that it is rules light. You know, there is a, you know, you can definitely make mistakes in both realms, because nobody wants to read like a math textbook to learn how to play a game. But at the same time, if your game can fit on like an index card, like, you know, it might not have enough material there to support like thoughtful play.
Well, and I think too, for me, it seems like, you know, there's always a trade-off of point, but it seems like the simpler systems can be much more fun, or can be a lot of fun for one shots. True. But it does not feel like, or maybe even just a few adventures, but they seem to be less satisfying for a longer play.
I can't speak to that, you know, personally, because I haven't attempted, you know, ongoing campaigns in a lot of these indie RPGs personally. But I can see that. I can definitely see that. I think that part of the longevity of systems like Pathfinder have been not just the fact that they got a bunch of supporting material and quests and stuff, but also just the fact there are a lot of options, you know. You know, nobody wants to play as a wizard their whole life. Sometimes you want to play as a different kind of character. But if your system only has 3 character classes, you know, it's not necessarily a bad system, but you're limiting the replay value, for lack of a better term. And you know, I don't know if there's a magic number, but I think definitely giving players more options is always a good thing. You know, I think that, you know, that makes it fun. You can just read through the book. You can read through Cyberblood and look at all the characters and have fun doing that, even if you never get a chance to roll the die, just because there's a lot to look at and there's a lot to kind of, you know, imagine with all the different combinations. That was like really important to me, because, you know, before I got a chance to play RPGs, that's what I did. You know, I didn't have anybody to play Dungeons and Dragons with when I bought my first book. I just read through the book, you know, over and over, because I thought it was interesting. I was like, this is super cool.
Yeah. And that's definitely, it definitely goes to show how things have changed, because So how long ago was it when you bought your D&D book?
Probably about 10 years ago.
So how old were you at 10 years ago?
I was in high school. So I graduated in 2013. So I probably bought my first role-playing book maybe like a year or two before that.
So did you live in a, like, you didn't have people to play with, were you like in a small town? I mean, what was the barrier?
I mean, you know, it's, I don't know. I should say that I think it was maybe before the kind of resurgence that role-playing games seem to have had in the last 5 years or so with like
because I think 5e just probably came out at that time.
I think 5e came out I want to say it came out like right after that, because my first book was a fourth edition book.
Okay.
I'm sure that if I looked hard enough, I could have found people, but, it was, you know, probably when I bought it, I didn't have a car yet, probably. And so it was, you know, and I didn't even know where to start. You know, it was at the time where I was like, I didn't know how many people were still playing this kind of game. You know, I kind of thought in my head, and this is obviously untrue, but in my head, I was like, Dungeons and Dragons is something that people played like, you know, in the 80s and 90s, and like nobody plays it anymore. So, you know, I didn't really.
It was a weird space at that time.
Yeah, it was like, you know, it was like after the kind of the hype had kind of dried up a little bit, because it was before the actual plays. It was before Stranger Things came out.
Well, the thing is, 3.5 was wildly popular. Fourth edition, not nearly as much.
Right.
And it let a lot of the steam out of the brand. So when you did come, you're right, it was before everything became hot. You picked up a book. This is the thing I was going to state, I shouldn't be making these types of statements when I've never read fourth edition. But when you started stating that about being character classes being kind of important, as far as what it did and it's kind of limited, it made me wonder if it was like fourth edition. And I think fourth edition, it seemed to be, from what I've heard, is the character classes and their interplay between the classes was very important. And it was a very streamlined as far as, I think, combat. I think character creation is more difficult, but.
Oh yeah.
So that being said, do you think fourth edition has a play in the sensibility of Cyberblood, or is it not really there?
I think that it definitely does. It definitely is part of its lineage. And it became less so over time, but if you look at, and it might not exist anymore, I do have a bunch of old versions of Cyberblood like that. Before the game was even called Cyberblood, I, you know, when it was just sort of a hobby, I was just like coming up with ideas on a Word document. I mean, it was at one point very similar to fourth edition, because that was the only reference I really had, you know, for a role-playing game. You know, I didn't know, you know, other systems at all, and I barely knew fourth edition. So there was definitely more DNA from fourth edition in the very prototype, like pre-alpha stages of Cyberblood. And some of the first changes between that like kind of prototype version, where it, you could almost say like it was almost like a homebrew of a fourth edition. It, you know, when I started doing away with, okay, we're getting rid of damage rolls because that's grinds everything to a halt. Yeah. We're getting rid of, you know, some other, you know, kind of strange movement. Fourth edition has this obsession with like very specific, like almost like dance like movement, where it's like if you're next to somebody on one side, it's got one term. If you're behind somebody, it has a specific term, and some abilities work and some don't. And so the positioning is like hugely important. It's basically a war game, you know. Yeah. Fourth edition is has a lot more in common with stuff like, you know, like I don't know, like Axis and Allies in some ways than it does with like other editions of D&D, but
well, but even looking through the adventures, the centerpiece for every adventure is the combat, and everything else seems to be secondary.
I can't speak to that too specifically with fourth edition because, like I said, I didn't really actually play that much.
I bought some modules because, like, they're really good price, and oh, this is cool. This is, you know, a drow. And I look at it, and it's like the whole focus was when where the battles are going to take place.
Yeah.
Anything else that you think would be like would be there wasn't. Like, I'm not saying there was no role playing or there wasn't any of this, but it's kind of like if you're to look at like stack out or like a chart out, you know, the various aspects of the game. It looks like 80% of the focus really was going to be on combat encounters and having the setup for that encounter. When I say setup, I mean the map, the layout right. of every single thing and how things are positioned and where people are. And I'm not saying that was going on with yours, but what's interesting is you talked about, you know, in third edition, they started offering all these choices. And then they offered so many classes, it just became kind of pointless. But it sounds like, if I recall correctly, fourth edition, very strongly with archetypes. And those archetypes were kind of what really defined the character. And they're doing less so that with fifth edition.
Yeah. You know, I haven't ever personally spoken with anybody who had any sort of development influence on those editions of Dungeons and Dragons, but I'd love to, because it is really between third, fourth, and fifth, it does really feel like they went through a different kind of philosophy when it came to how they wanted to depict the game. And I just did an interview yesterday, in fact, with World of Game Design. And we ended up talking about a similar sort of thing about how, you know, with Dungeons and Dragons, sometimes there is this kind of push against combat, not just from the player base, but also from Wizards of the Coast themselves, where they really want to push how important the role play is and how the adventure can be your own and how combat's not that important. But when you open up the book, even fifth edition, when you open up the book, 80% of the book is rules about combat or options for combat, which is not a bad thing, but it's that the messaging of the company and of the player base completely conflicts with the actual.
Well, not even that, rules. Just the rules. What rules do they really have for social encounters?
Right. Yeah. and you know, I'm not an expert on fifth edition, but I think it's just that, like, they expect that to be the thing that the players bring to the table, which is fair. You know,
I disagree. I think the really? Thing is be, well, no, because how can you expect them to do it? Why does everything else get so much detail?
I don't know. I think that it's really hard to, I think that's really hard to kind of prescribe like what's supposed to be like kind of a, like almost like improv. Or gamify improv too much. Maybe that's what it is. I'm, you know, I haven't thought about it too deeply because my expectation as a game master is always that it is kind of my job to bring the characters in the story and for the players to kind of go along with it.
But why is it that part with, why is combat not improv then?
I don't know. I guess it's because it's more math based, whereas social encounters aren't necessarily always math based in a game.
But they could be.
They could be. But I talked to somebody, an older guy. It's like a family friend of mine, actually. And we were talking about Dungeons and Dragons one time. And I was talking about how I was like playing with I was running a game that did not last very long. And I remember I kind of complained. I said, when my players are trying to convince someone of something or like do like a charisma style kind of role or skill check, I don't like quite understand how to like operate that. Because like if they roll if they roll really low, they basically don't bother doing any role playing because they're like, well, I'm going to fail this anyway, so I won't role play. But if they roll really high, they also kind of phone it in because they're like, well, I got a really high number, so why should I bother like trying to convince you? Cause like I got a 23 or something, you know? And his response was basically, well, you just need to have them. You need to have a rule set like as a DM that it doesn't matter what the player rolls. If they don't actually perform, if they don't actually role play, then the role is like not counted basically. And if they roll poorly, but role play really well, you can still count it as like a success because ultimately it's a role playing game. And if somebody's like busting their ass trying to role play, it kind of doesn't seem right to say like, well, you didn't get this particular number, so it doesn't count, you know?
But here's a twist. So let's say I'm not a charismatic person. I don't consider myself a charismatic person, but let's say I'm not a charismatic person. But I want to play a character that is charismatic.
Mm.
I cannot role play my way out of a wet paper sack.
Mm-hmm.
But I want my character to be able to do that.
Right. That's a good question. That's like saying that's the equivalent of being like, well, I'm not that smart of a person, but my character's intelligence is really high. My character is a genius, yeah. But I'm not a genius. How do you role play someone who's smarter than you are?
Exactly.
I think you're getting into a more philosophical question than a game design question, but.
Well, no, I disagree because have you seen the NPC reaction tables with the BX, D&D, the BX system?
I've seen reaction tables before, but not specifically with that.
Yeah, so you got like five different things that could roll up. You roll and see what the initial reaction is, and it modifies it. It tells a general mood. You could easily set up things that they could roll, and maybe it doesn't complete, but changes where they're at.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with you. I think there's definitely a market for. I mean, you can go on Amazon and see multiple different books of like random NPC generators. You know, where it's like you turn to a page and here are all the names. You turn to another page, here are the professions. You turn to a third page, here are like recognizable quirks. Like, oh, they have a scar on their cheek, or they rub their hands together when they talk, something like that, you know? So that stuff does like definitely exist. And would you in like systems that have a lot of, a lot of hands working on them, would more robust generators like that be something that you would want to see?
I think what I would look for is a simple unified system. And I think I don't think it'd be that difficult to do. I do know that, I've not played extensively, but I played a character in Shadowrun and I played a face, and I regret once I pulled out a pistol. I could have played that entire game and never drew a pistol.
Mm-hmm.
And I succeeded by bribery the whole time. And you can't really, I don't know that other systems allow you to do that.
Yeah. Because you should be able to play that way. You know, I agree. And I think that, rules don't always have explicit design for that kind of behavior. But I think that Cyberblood does have some of that depending on the character class that you're playing as. I'm a big proponent of sort of empowering players and game masters alike, where, you know, multiple times throughout the book, I remind the reader that, you know, like your game master is going to have the final say here, you know, how you kind of determine this particular thing.
Right.
Because sometimes I think people get hung up on like the actual, what does the book say? And they forget that it is a collaborative kind of experience. You know, everyone, the game master is also a player, and you want to make sure that they are, being treated as such.
Well, especially as an indie designer, you can't do everything. And I do think social encounters and how you manage that is not always straightforward and easy as roll to see if you hit with a sword, roll damage to see if you kill a person. Because there's a lot of nuances right. in there. And I do recognize that, but I do also see that early on there was some very easy low-hanging fruit that could have been developed and just got shoved aside. And so, like, for instance, what's happened is, you know, there was morale rules for creatures that were in early editions of D&D. They took them away. So what does that do? And that's why I ran for years and years. Monsters just attack until they're all dead. That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
It's created, there's been a lot of technology that has gotten thrown away early on that actually probably makes more sense for gameplay. You can make for a richer game. Like even the NPC reaction tables, you just don't know for those characters or those even monsters that you come across. Maybe those hobgoblins are just wanting to trade.
Yeah, and for Cyberblood specifically, and I totally agree with you. I think that having that kind of extra layer to things can really help, especially if the game master at hand doesn't necessarily have a specific view of the type of thing that's going on. But for Cyberblood, and I do, you know, we do plan on writing and releasing more mission modules and expansions as well. And when it comes to those specific encounters that we are writing, that we are kind of writing out and saying, these are the characters involved, these are our expectations about them. You know, there will be character descriptions where it's like, this character is kind of a psychopath. They will fight to the death. They're right. looking to cause as much carnage as possible. Whereas you might read another character and they're just a security guard. And if you stick a 50 caliber gun in their face, they're going to hand you their keys and say, I didn't see anything, you know, and they're going to give themselves the night off. They're not going to, you know, throw down their life for their minimum wage security job and at 3 a.m. you know, why would they?
Right.
So, but that's where I think that, you know, core rules, I don't think that's necessarily the job for core rules. I think that is something specific to your quests and your missions. And that's where that kind of content should be as a writer. That's what I would do.
Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. I just think that there's a lot of opportunities. So to do different in different ways, and there's no necessarily right or wrong. I just kind of lament the fact that I think things have gotten ignored. It could have been, I think, a lot of the things are going back to in exploring things that were thrown away. I think we're in a really good, as far as RPG design space, we're in a very, we're still relatively new and, things are being done that no really thought could be done before or not could be done. But I think there's definitely explorations in a lot of new areas, which is a good thing. So you're planning on extending this thing out, more missions, more content once this Kickstarter's done, once you recover from the
shockwave.
So is World of Game Design, are they doing the distribution for you too?
Yeah, their World of Game Design is partnered with us currently to do to help a little bit with the Kickstarter because they have experience with that in the past, and also to do a little bit of the publicity as well as distribution, and they're going to be storing, you know, the physical product because, you know, that just simplifies things for us. They also have just more of a tradition of going to conventions, which is going to open, you know, Cyberblood up to just being exposed to more people who aren't on the social medias that I am. And, you know, Cyberblood is not my full-time job. You know, I'd love it if it was, but it's not. And, you know, it is their full-time job to kind of distribute this stuff and get it out there. So it's going to just hopefully help it reach a larger audience and get more people involved.
Yeah, it's, and I've used them for quite a few Kickstarters, and Zach and team, and not to forget Troy, who does the mailings, among other things. They've been actually very good to work with. I'm very pleased. So is there any plans on applying this to different genres?
You mean like using the system?
Yeah.
Not not particularly at this point. I think the system is definitely adaptable so that it could possibly support other genres beyond cyberpunk. But you know, it is quite ingrained with that sort of genre that the you would have to do a pretty major overhaul for it to work that way. And at that point, I would almost just say, just write a different system. You know, but I did have a player, one of my play testers, who was a big fan of the system. He homebrewed a Half-Life inspired game based on Cyberblood system. So using all of the Cyberblood like mechanics and rules, but set in the Half-Life universe with Half-Life character classes and weapons and the alien races that are in that universe. So it's possible, it's doable, but it's not currently something we're looking at like officially. We're focused on adding more content to Cyberblood, the sci-fi aspect of it, and there's going to be different like kind of subgenres in there. Like not every cyberpunk story is the same. You know, not every single one is going to be breaking into an office and stealing a black box and handing it to a guy in a suit. You know, we have about 12 mission modules kind of outlined. Some of them involve kind of these psychic characters, these espers. Some of them involve kind of large scale kind of military conflicts. And then some of them are horror themed. So we, you know, I ran one with a playtest group that was they didn't know it when they started it, but it was a horror kind of cyberpunk that took place in like a derelict, underwater kind of station. It does support a lot of different kind of subgenres, but we are currently focused on, you know, sci-fi and cyberpunk specifically.
So why did you decide to go the route that you did with this particular system? Was it just because you felt comfortable with the D20 and thought that was the path, or, I mean, what, cause you had a lot of choices as far as other mechanics that are being used out there.
Yeah, I think it was just because it was a very common system, and it was one that I was familiar with from playing my limited experience with role-playing games at the time. And as I started to kind of adapt the system and it became more and more different over the months and years that I worked on it, it just felt like a good kind of system of math that allowed for like enough granularity to have like a lot of good kind of, you know, variety without it being like overly statistic based. You know, I think if you start using like big numbers, it gets a little too, you know, requiring too many calculators and whatnot. You know, that's when you start getting into like the war game kind of zone. But I felt that like having the D20 and the kind of mostly single digit kind of modifiers to skills was a just such a solid core that I was comfortable with. And I thought it worked for the system and seems to have gone okay.
Well, I think too, it's like, you know, you look at the robustness of the longevity of the system, what you've done is taken something and kind of whittled it down at a point where, and with enough play testing that you realize how far you could go without creating problems. So, I mean, where if you do something from scratch, it's, there's a lot more, I think, risk and time trying to get things to balance out correctly.
Yeah, for sure. If you're, you know, starting with a baseline is always going to give you as a creator a little bit of a boost. So totally agree. Yeah.
You whittle away, you add a little bit, you whittle away, you add a little bit, and then you finally get things tuned to how you want them. And I think also it's easy to, I think sometimes with new systems, like designers, especially sometimes get overly enamored with certain things that it's like, You should have left that alone. This is becoming more too complicated, or this particular mini system is, you know, like, what's this doing here? But I think once you got a solid foundation, you know how it's supposed to work. And you're just, all you're doing is making it work the way you want it to work.
Yeah. And I don't think there's anything wrong with experimentation, but I do think that I agree with you. Generally speaking, I think that sometimes, you know, that is something I've noticed with a lot of the like indie games, is sometimes the ones that decide that they're not going to do the rules light route, they really create some very bizarre and like esoteric kind of systems that, you know, maybe make like good marketing, because it's like, it's, you know, oh, our game is based on tarot cards, or our game is based on, you know, every turn you're going to flip three coins and add up whether they're heads or tails and like all that stuff. And it's like, none of that stuff is like inherently bad or like bad design necessarily, but sometimes you're like really reinventing the wheel, you know, unnecessarily, when a lot of these, you know, indie games have these really fascinating, like beautiful, like settings and cool ideas for games. But when you look at the rules, you are really thrown a little bit, because, you know, people don't get into role-playing games because they want to learn a bunch of rules. People get into role-playing games because they want to inhabit a cool world with cool characters. And the rules are just a means to do that, you know, inhabitation, you know. And so the rules should always be there to support that kind of fantasy of getting into that character or world. If you create rules that are just a little bit too strange, you know, you're gonna lose some people.
I think one of the I've never played it, and what I've heard is the original Deadlands, it's a horror Western.
Right.
The original game, you played with a deck of cards,
yeah,
playing cards. And I guess people loved it. It just felt that Western theme. The mechanics were solid, and those playing cards just added to the ambience of it all. But more often than not, you're like you're saying, it's kind of a distraction. Or if you're saying the tarot cards might seem cool, but now you got to make sure you have tarot cards with you, or, you know what I mean? Right. It's like three quarters of the mechanics work great, but the one quarter, you know, maybe it doesn't. And it's kind of trying to be beholden. And I think there's one designer that I think has been notable for Fantasy Flight. And he also went to Modiphius, and it's like, a friend of mine, I think, thinks the problem is these people are very smart, just a little too clever. And usually once they leave and then there's two more revisions, then the system actually is where it should be. So
yeah,
sometimes it just takes it's like an editor. It's like, you may have a brilliant writer, but the brilliant writer just needs an editor. But if you have too strong of a writer and no editor, then the book's going to be a hot mess.
Yeah. I mean, it's the classic design advice to like kill your darlings or whatever, or, you know, when you create something that like, maybe when you started it or you had this like bright idea that was like really cool in your head, and you can make it work if you really force it and you really get in that specific zone. But you have to remember that unless your game exists purely as like a thought experiment, like if you actually want people to play it, you know, most people, you know, aren't going to be able to perfectly inhabit the mental space that you were at when you came up with this harebrained idea, you know? So the more approachable you can make a game without sacrificing what makes it special, the better you're going to be, you know? And some people might turn their nose up at that and say like, well, I'm not making my game for the lowest common denominator. I want my game to be, you know, my game's elite. My game is for people who really care. And like, I get that, but also like, don't you want more people to have fun with your game? Like, don't, you know, why would you want to put obstacles in your own way? You know?
So it's kind of interesting. So, you know, I grew up, I'm obviously older than you. And so I find it interesting that certain genres kind of went away, or they're very strong for, say my generation. But I also find it interesting when other people of a different generation pick things up, like cyberpunk. So I'm going to turn on a light because it's starting to get dark. Yeah. So I grew up in the 80s, and that was the whole, like, you know, that's a lot of the corporations, you know, the corporations taking over, yada, yada. It's a little different situation now. So for you, what was it that drew you into the cyberpunk genre?
I think largely it was that I liked the kind of, I think what drew me in initially was the aesthetic for it, you know, and maybe that's not the coolest answer, but I think it's the most honest answer, is that I liked the look and the feel and the sound of that kind of vibe. And I liked the kind of endless city and the darkness of it, and the fact that people had this really kind of cold kind of technology that seemed really like inhuman, but it wasn't like science fiction, like far flung science fiction. It wasn't like Star Wars and ray guns and aliens. It was like this more realistic science fiction, in the sense that it was like all very earth-based and very much like focused that way. And that to me was really attractive and interesting. And when I started learning more about the subgenre and kind of looking at different media that, you know, was, you know, considered cyberpunk, I was like, oh, there's like a lot to like about this from a kind of like philosophical point of view that is like below the surface. You know, it's the more interesting like kind of stuff when it comes to the writing. So, and then that's like your, you know, that's like your stuff where corporations are taking over. Do they suppress or supplant governments and people, you know, people's lives are less valuable because there's a much larger like concentration of human population, you know? So there's a lot more interesting in that regard. And there's so many great cyberpunk stories, some of which are played totally straight, like your Matrix or your Bubblegum Crisis or your Blade Runner. And then some are like satirical, like your RoboCop or your Snow Crash, which are all just amazing stories and all have these amazing characters and set pieces. But, you know, they all kind of deal with like different sides of that kind of the cyberpunk kind of genre. And so there's just so much to draw from. And like you said, it kind of died back in the 2000s. And that's kind of why, like, I think Cyberblood's aesthetic is intentionally kind of, maybe retro is the wrong term, but it's intentionally rooted in like 80s and 90s kind of aesthetics. You know, I had like one of the examples is we have a character in the artwork who is depicted with like a cyber dog. He's this like robot dog. And, the initial designs I got back from the artist were very Boston Dynamics, you know, much like it was a rectangle with no head and it had four legs that ended in little stumps. And I was like, this is cool. And this is probably what a robot dog would look like now, but that's not what we're going for. We want like, what is the 80s cyberhound? You know, what does this look like? And then he's like, okay, I get what you mean. And he comes back to me with what we have now, which is, it looks a lot more like a canine. It's got pointed ears. It's got like a little visor instead of eyes. And it's, you know, it's got like metal teeth, almost like a bear trap, you know, like that's maybe not the most realistic thing. You know?
Well, I agree with what you're doing. And I think like, for instance, I've not played a lot of Shadowrun, but I do know that the different, so Shadowrun started in the 80s, the game. So, but the technology, they could not foresee the future. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we have the Matrix, but wireless technology just wasn't a thing.
Yeah.
And so as they have progressed with each new version, edition, they increase the year, but they've had to add more technology. So when you read it through it, you can kind of see how new technology is developing that they didn't foresee that they're having to have to incorporate and look into the future with. It's really kind of an odd thing where if you take something like Traveler, a sci-fi game that was written in the 70s. And even though it's got modern sensibilities, it's still largely played like a 70s sci-fi. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a legitimacy to saying, you know what, we're not playing what we really think the future is. We're playing the future as the, how they saw it in the 80s, like you said. And that is absolutely, I think, the most honest, legitimate, and probably the most straightforward way to deal with it. And you know, you can say to somebody, it's like, this is not anything else but an 80s version of the future. And it, that I think allows you a lot more, more license to do things without having to worry about, like, you know, what is a General Dynamics dog going to look like in 15 years? Like, who cares? Yeah. I don't really care. I want to know what they thought about in the 80s or the 90s. That's what's important.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that staying true to like a core aesthetic and like a core kind of whatever was the, you know, inspiration is only beneficial. And I think that's why, like, you know, you could see it, you can see it a lot in something like the when they made the Star Wars movies, not the sequels that they did, but when they made the ones that was like, they did the one that was like the Han Solo, like kind of origin story.
Yeah.
Like that movie in particular really like mimes the art style of like the original movies in a way that the later ones don't.
Yeah.
And I think that was like such an incredible decision because it feels more like Star Wars because they tried to make things look more like the 70s version of Star Wars as opposed to like the newer version of Star Wars where all the stormtroopers look like, you know, they look like overly sleek and overly modern. And you kind of lose a lot of that vibe.
Well, so, even George Lucas with episode one right away went to the shiny aesthetic with CGI mm-hmm. where it's like, this doesn't make sense. I mean, the costume age, the ships, it's just like, you've just made the past look better than the future for it. It makes no sense.
Yeah. It did have kind of a strange kind of like swap there. And, you know, at a certain level, you have to be like, well, you know, sensibilities change and he's a filmmaker and wanted to do something different. And you can make a whole bunch of conceits about it. But yeah, like there is a reason why sticking to a specific art style, like going out of your way to like limit yourself within a box is going to actually, in many ways, make you more creative. And it's going to ground your, you know, when talking about a game, it's going to ground your players more because they're going to, if you tell someone where the limits are, they're going to understand what their characters are able to do. And by that same measure, if a character or an entity or a villain or something can do something outside of that box, then all of a sudden they are like a major threat, or that is like a major catastrophe, or it is a notable thing if all of a sudden you have these very specific rules and then somebody breaks them. And I think that you can't really do that if your system or your movie or your world is just like everything thrown together. It just doesn't, you can't ever pull that off if you've got that sort of like, oh, everything in the kitchen sink is in there. Limitations are hugely important to creativity.
So I've never played Eclipse Phase, but that one is probably one of the most modern takes of sci-fi in the future, which includes, you know, the body modifications and sleeving and what is personality, what is humanity. I mean, all these kinds of things, but even though you could technically do the same type of missions, it will never feel like a traveler adventure. It's just too out there. But likewise, you can't take a traveler game and make it into an Eclipse Phase. It just, you can't, they became their own things. And I think standing by whatever it is that you're doing, and planting your flagpole, or planting your flag is really the right way to be and just stick to it. And like with Traveler, it's like, you know, you're not going to have all these things like we know now. It doesn't matter. It's just, we're not playing that. And I think, especially when you're dealing with movies, those are touchstones that people all agree with. Like we're playing RoboCop world. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, you know, it's not explicit in the marketing material, but it's a big kind of design touchstone for me, is that for Cyberblood, you know, kind of the military and like police force aesthetic is like maybe the other side of that coin. Whereas you look at, you know, that's why I like to say 80s action movies and anime. And when I that and anime, I'm talking specifically Ghost in the Shell and Bubblegum Crisis, which are these anime that are both centered. They're both 90s anime, and they're both centered on like kind of like special forces or like police who are dealing with science fiction threats in their city. And so that kind of military aesthetic is also like very influential on Cyberblood, in the sense that like a lot of the lore of the world is given through the weapons. You know, every single weapon in the game, there's like 250 of them. Every single one has a description, and sometimes the description just describes literally what the weapon is and what it does. But then some of the descriptions go a little further. They talk about who manufactured it. They talk about why it was manufactured, for what purpose does it serve. And that sort of like military chic is also kind of something that really codifies like what was important in Cyberblood. Not that you necessarily have to play as a military character or a police officer character, but that is kind of the world that you're living in. You're living in a world that really values security, and it is a world that has so many people that security has become like a commodity. You know, you've got a lot of threats, a lot of inequality when it comes to wealth, you know, a very extreme version of what we have in the real world. And the kind of the outcome of that is that you have a lot of unhappy people and a lot of people who are willing to do pretty desperate things to kind of get themselves out of whatever situation they're in. And so you can definitely tell some pretty serious stories, and you can tell more, more kind of adventurous, you know, bizarro stories as well.
Well, that's good. It sounds like you've got a nice open system where you've not created too many rails to limit creativity, but still also enough rail to actually just not be everything to everybody. Cause I think it's kind of like with a lot of some games that they've, even with like universal role-playing games, it's like they offer that promise, but really their sweet spot's generally much more narrow than what they try and state. Yeah. I don't know if you've played those. So 1 week you've got a Kickstarter coming up. So you can go now and push the notify me at launch button.
Yeah, please do. I don't know exactly how the Kickstarter algorithm works, but I do know that the more people click that button, the more likely we are to make it onto the homepage of Kickstarter, or to get that little star that says that it's a project that Kickstarter likes. And that's, I imagine that's hugely helpful for projects.
Well, yeah, whatever juice. And I think the thing is even if, of course, you know, as people who, you know, running a Kickstarter, you want every person that clicks to notify me at launch to purchase. Right. The fact is that if you just click that early on, it actually doesn't cost you anything, and it doesn't obligate you to anything as far as a consumer. You can click it and just say, you know what, at least I want to help Michael out by at least clicking this. Maybe it'll help juice up the algorithm. So it's there's nothing to lose by clicking the notify me at launch.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would also say that, like, if this at all sounds, I mean, if you made it to the end of this recording, then you probably are at least a little bit interested. So go check out cyberblood.net and look at the artwork we have, look at the characters. We have amazing artists that are doing work for the game. And I would say that, you know, if my rambling here hasn't sold you on it, I think the artwork definitely will, because, you know, Cyberblood, you know, so much of the personality has been influenced by the amazing artists we worked with. Logan Stahl did the character art, and this just really cool, like, you know, comic book 80s kind of vibe came from, you know, from him. So
are you doing any, I forget what they're called, as you get certain pledge levels, I forgot the term for it.
You're talking about like incentives?
Yeah. No, I forgot the term for it because I never do them. People ask why I don't have those, not the add-ons. Whenever you reach a certain funding level, you unlock a certain thing.
Stretch goals?
Stretch goals. Yeah. Are you doing any stretch goals?
Yeah. The thing with our stretch goals is that we want to really make the stretch goals something that's going to like just improve the product, like in a meaningful way as a whole. So we're not promising, like, we're not going to reinvent the wheel with these stretch goals or anything, but you know, this is a project where the, you know, the stretch goals are going to go to stuff like additional interior artwork. So the interior of these books is just going to get more stuff on more pages. It's going to be, it's just going to be like, just a higher quality, more deep product. We've got Kickstarter like stretch goals that are like modifications and improvements to the physical book itself. So like kind of laminated covers or heat treated UV covers, which is basically just like a fancy term for having like kind of like a special gloss on parts of the cover that's not on the other part, which doesn't sound like much verbally, but when you see it, you're like, oh, this is like a big difference. World map we want to do. We want to include additional, like an additional chapter all about like the lore, like expanded lore. If we do really well, we're going to release a separate like zine that's all about like the corporations in Cyberblood. A lot of this stuff is stuff that's just going to like, you're going to notice just like an overall improvement on the quality of the product. Some of the lore stuff might come down like later in the line, like on separate products.
Right.
But, so it's, you know, it's never like, you know, going to be too late, but you know, it, getting it early and getting it with these other products is going to be just like a huge, like boon to game masters who want to run this stuff and have access to, you know, all of the cool stories and jumping off points for their campaigns. And that's exactly what we want, you know, to empower the game masters to bring these cool stories to their players.
And that's what I think the intent of Kickstarter. I mean, I never do any of those because I have everything. My ideal state is to actually have proof copies in hand before the Kickstarter starts. So I don't want to do anything that limits it, but I think what you're doing makes a whole lot of sense. And that's what probably is I don't say it's the right thing, but it has a very good way of saying, you know, the money's going is really not just going to the project, but the more it makes, the more robust it will be. And I think that's definitely laudable. Then hopefully you'll fund really well and knock out all those stretch goals.
Yeah. And we're the same way. I mean, we've got the game itself is done, you know, the game itself is done. The core rules are done. All of the items and stuff, that's all complete. The Kickstarter, what that money is going to, you know, stretch goals not included, what that money is going to is manufacturing, you know, making sure our artists are paid and making sure that we can pay the next wave of artists and writers in producing the content that comes next. So, you know, that is the proof copy right here. You know,
you may be adding to that book though, as far as art goes.
Yeah. So like this book, this is the proof copy.
That's hard bound. So that's not cheap. Who did the printing for that?
So this was done by Mixam, but we are going with a different manufacturer for the final product. But $100
right there in your hand.
The proof coffees are a little bit more than the production run copies are going to be.
It cost me $100 with shipping for a hardbound copy, hardcover copy.
Yeah, these are not going to be $100 for you guys.
No, it's you get in volume. It's just that one that doing proof copies is very expensive. I never did this with so what I do is I do non-US backers. I fulfill using Lulu, and I use for US backers I use Mixum. So Mixum's better quality and it's more money, but I usually do my first proof copy with Lulu because it's cheaper for doing the proof copy. So I get all my mistakes made there. I'm not sure about the hardcovers, how those are, but you don't use Lulu at all. Then you're just going to be,
No, we're probably going with Print Ninja for the final. I was just on the phone with them the other day. I mean, I'm relatively uninformed about different manufacturers. So if you recommend Lulu, I'll check
Them out. The reason I recommend Lulu, I'm not recommending Lulu necessarily, but what I do is they're print on demand. So what I can do is I can open up to non-US backers, and then that they don't have to pay outrageous postage.
Oh, that makes sense.
So for like a zine, I can ship a zine in the UK for $6.50.
Oh yeah, it's not bad at all.
And maybe Australia, it's been a bit. So, you know, and it could go up to like $10, $12 is the high point. But if actually ship from the US, it would be three times that amount. It's insane. Yes. So that's the advantage of Lulu's. If you want to do print on demand, it's cheaper. And you can also do the same thing with Drive Through RPG. You can use their system. But what it's doing is adding complexity.
Yeah, and you know, this is my first rodeo, you know. So I'm just learning the ropes, you know. I'd love to offer more complex options.
You can do that with the next Kickstarter. Options. Get one or two under your belt.
Yeah.
I didn't do hardcover. I just did softcover with Lulu, but you could next Kickstarter if you want to go that route, then you could just offer that as an option on Lulu as well.
Yeah. The whole cover issue has been a bit of a sticking point because we want to do hardcover. I was initially going to do paperback, but you know, the guys at World of Game Design thought hardcover was the way to go, but we're still trying to work out the kinks a little bit because we want the quality of the hardcover to be like good. Like, if we're going to spend the extra cash to produce a more expensive product, we want it to be worth it. That's something that we've been working on the last couple of days, is trying to figure out like what kinks need to get worked out with this hardcover and how the production run is going to be different. It's all new to me, but I'm learning.
Yeah, I hear you. So well good luck with that, and you're in good hands with Zach and gang.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think we'll be dropping this on Saturday. So
then awesome.
Luke should publish everything else back. So anyway, thanks again for joining me, Michael.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me and letting me ramble with you.